Hello, everybody here at Fostum at the Lightning Talks. I want to introduce to you Klaus Ehrlich, and he's talking about treating build definitions independent of their origin. Give him a warm welcome and enjoy the talk.
Okay, thank you very much. As the title suggests, I want to look into how build definitions are treated, especially internally in the build system, and why I believe that it's important to have that independent of where the definition is coming from. And of course, that's all implemented in free and open source software. And since it's a lightning talk, let's jump right to an example. I brought you a makefile, not because I believe makefiles are particularly close to be independent of where the definition is, but because a lot of people can read makefiles, so I hope you understand what this example is all about. In fact, makefiles are pretty the opposite of what I think. So makefile says you have targets, these are files, and they are identified by a pass into the file system. And then you say, well, this file better be newer than some of those other files. And if not, then there's a command to run, and hopefully it will have the right side effect. And that it's all about side effects is something you notice if you look at all those phony targets that don't even create a file, they're just there for the side effects. Still, makefiles are used to build software. So there is a computational content to that, and let's have a look at how that might look like, or actually does look like in the build tool I'm working on. So we have this first object file, it's a file, and we say, well, it is the output of running some command. It's actually the output at location foo.o. The interesting thing is obviously what is behind that hash there, and it's an action. So what is an action given by? Well, you run some command. Since it's a makefile, you probably have a string, that indented string, and then pass it to a shell. You specify some environment variables, definitely pass. Makefiles just use the ambient pass on the invocation, but to get it well-defined, you specify something, either something very generic, as here in that example, or something very specific to the installation, like a Nix pass or so. The interesting thing is, so now how do we talk about files? I say, I don't want to say, well, take the file from there in the file system. And there I use that it is a committed source file, and nowadays people voluntarily use Git, so we can use the Git blob identifier to identify a file, and then we define it by its content rather than, oh, it happens to be there on my disk. Okay, the next thing is, well, it gets more interesting if you look at this library. Well, of course, it's also some output of some action. But if you look at that action, well, we also have a command. We expect one file to be created. And as an input, well, we have the output of the previous action. And that is the hash you just seen. So in that way, we can encode the whole action graph into these identifiers and have a description, first of all, independent of where on my disk the source files were, but also with that I get an action graph, and having all this input-output very explicit, I'm independent of running the command in the same working directory. I can have a separate directory if I put all the files in where they belong to and get out the expected outputs, and that way I can also use remote execution or whatever, distributed over many machines, and maybe share cache fits with other ones working the same thing. But the more interesting thing, if you look at targets. So makefile, we have files. But if you look at that makefile, you see, well, there are two libraries, foo and bar. And if you look at bar, some of the inputs is also seems to be that foo.hpp. So there is a dependency. Well, hidden in terms of that makefile, and I guess that's why these handwritten makefiles got out of fashion. And you want to make that structure explicit. So you write something like that, saying, well, I have foo, it is a library, it has headers, it has sources, say, so is bar, but bar depends on foo, and I have an application, a binary, that depends on bar, and only implicitly then depends on foo. So I should mention a bit about the syntax here, this reference to the build rule, saying it's a library, I'm referencing to a build rule, because as a build rule, I can't know any programming language on earth, so I want that delegated to a separate rule set, and since this toy example here in my talk is not the only C++ project that should be built by the tool, this C++ specific knowledge is, of course, in a separate logical repository, And that syntax is kind of a Lisp-like way of writing some type. The first character, first empty says which kind of addressing a rule it is, in this case a rule in a separate repository. That repository is called roots from that project. There you find a directory called cc, and there you find a rule description file, and from that you better take the entry library. Okay, so what does a rule do? It takes all the inputs and then gives a description of the output. And we've seen already how you can talk about files without having to build them. And if you look at foo, we get something. Well, we get a primary artifact, which is a library. It is created by some action. And here you see that the rules are a bit more elaborate than what I've shown on the introductory examples, because you want maybe the compiler as an input implicit to your toolchain as well. So you have to move everything to a subdirectory to make space for the compiler being an input of that action. That's why the output path is in a subdirectory. And now it doesn't look as ridiculous as in the past that, well, we take the output called foo and put it at position foo. And you also have the header file, because to use the library you need the header file. And the only other useful information in a library that doesn't depend on anything else is, well, the linking. If you want to link against this library, that is what you should at your linker command line. It gets more interesting if you now take the library var that depends on foo. We still get a primary artifact, which is a library. We still get a header file. But we get the additional information that, well, if you want to compile against that library, you better include that header file foo as well. And the same if you want to link, well, you don't only need our primary artifact bar, you also need that other library, which we depend upon, and the linker command line says, well, first bar, then foo, so that the open library symbols from bar are found in foo. And that is something where we get away from the way we define the library. So that is all the information we need. So we no longer have to reflect that it's coming from a library that actually depended on another library. We can depend on that description. That is the only thing that a consuming target gets. And by including it here, we basically can forget about the build description. We have all the information we need. And there's a second thing we can do. Here we have description of files still in as an introduction on how to build them. We can actually do that, and then we get this. See how the hashes have changed? Now it's more concrete, or actually what we have replaced is all the description of an action by the result of running that action. So that is now basically a package. We can use it. We have some contractable store where you can store the files, and that's also why it's no harm of having the files duplicated and everyone depending on it, because the only thing we depend copying is the hash saying, well, that is where we refer to. And so that's why it's basically a package, and it's just a small projection. When can we replace such a library by its kind of package version? Well, if the repository hasn't changed, so we have to have a look at repositories. So first, this is again the build description. If you say, well, this bar is something that should be reusable, then I just rename that entry, but I didn't change the definition, so it's still the same thing. And then as a new bar, I say, well, basically take that bar and make it reusable, and I have to provide some information, which I haven't really talked about. There is a configuration that you can debug, build, etc. And I have to specify which part of the configuration should be taken into account. The rest is thrown away. That way, I can immediately know what is relevant. And now I have to talk about repositories. This is literally what I added to these examples. I'm saying, well, here you find, take the current working directory, but actually it's a Git repository, take the head commit. And the same is for the rules. I have, when I talk about rules, I mean that repository in some parallel path. And again, it's a Git repository, take the Git commit associated with that. I could have also specified some branch or whatever in some external repository instead of copying it here. In any case, what I get is this. I'm saying, okay, you've got a repository and the root is just that Git tree identifier. And in case you don't know what the tree identifier looks, there's some repository where you can look it up. And that's actually what this already gives me. I don't need a checkout. I'm building against the repository with these tree identifiers because I create a fresh directory for action anyway. And now the first time I'm showing the tool I'm working on, which is called just build. So you call the repository tool, you just ask it to analyze the target, well, you get precisely what I've shown in the earlier slides. So that file mentioned there is just the repository description I've shown you. The interesting thing is saying, well, I went through a target that is meant for caching, and here's the cache key. That's why I increased the lock limit. What does it contain? Well, the target inside that repository and the configuration and a description of the repository. Again, the interesting thing is what comes from that git blob identifier. And now here you see the graph. So the basic message is you only have the trees, because the tree of a source repository determines the source tree completely, no matter where you start that thing or where you got that repository from. So that is a key. And the other thing is I only looked at the definition of the naming, so I could also, well, in order to make it a canonical key, rename the repository names by taking the entry point 0 and then enumerating some canonical traversal. So that's why the bindings are there changed. And now if I build something that uses that library, well, you get some answer, you compute some build actions, but as a side effect, you evaluate that package. So if you now look at the same library again, you'll see the other definition with the package. All the action graph is gone, and by gone, I really mean gone. If I build it, it says no actions at all. And in fact, it's not only that they're all cached, but the analysis now says, well, we have a package definition of that. We can use it from there. Of course, that requires to use it that this repository, the graph I've shown, doesn't change. So it's mainly useful for someone from an external repository, logical one. Could be several subdirectory consumes that library. And there is one more thing. I've shown you in detail all the keys. So it's basically the Git tree. Of course, you never specify dependency or I want that Git tree. But the way you specify it is something like, oh, I want that archive or that release or that commit or that tag of some Git project or something like that. And there's, of course, a functional dependency from the commit ID to the tree ID or from this is the hash of an archive, what is the tree if you unpack that archive. So you can build a service that answers that questions. And I mean, that service, of course, needs to know all the sources, but whenever you use a project, you should have a backup copy of this upstream sources anyway, even for the third-party projects. And from that information, I can compute the tree, the cache key that I've just shown you. And the next thing is that contains all the information to build it. So I can have a service that works with the remote execution service I might use anyway to share computation, not only to distribute it by it, but also to share it with others working on the same project. And in that way, I can really I'm in the situation that I can take the project I'm working on, do a checkout, do my changes, build, and all the dependencies I don't even have to fetch, they stay on my service, and I have all the benefits as if I were bootstrapping all the dependencies without having to clutter these things around, because if in the end the only thing is I bootstrap a particular compiler, that can as well stay on the remote execution together with service backing up the sources. Yeah, so a bit faster than I thought I would be. So that is basically the message I want to say. What is the takeaway message? First of all, definitions are an interesting object in their own right. You can take them, you can serialize them, you can send them over the wire, you can store them in some containerizable store. And if you focus on how things are defined rather than at which place they are defined, that has some benefits. For example, you see this transition between building and package building. You've seen that, oh, I just replaced that one hash by another hash and the meaning of that hash. And of course, as I said, it's all free and open source software. You can download it from GitHub, and depending on what you use, you might also find it in your favorite package repository. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your talk.